You're listening to According to Sam, episode 88. Hello, welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 88. Thank you so much for listening. I had a really good show for you today. It seems like they are determined to get the riots and looting and mayhem that we experienced last summer. It looks like they're determined to get that kicked off again this year, one way or another. And it seemed, you know, after the Derek Chauvin verdict that people could breathe and there's not going to be mass riots burning down our cities. And because the riots and the looting had already started. Remember last week we talked about that because of the kid that was shot in Brooklyn City, Minnesota, just a few miles outside of where the trial was going on for Derek Chauvin. And they had already started looting and rioting and burning and confrontations with the police. And people were on edge. They were like, and I even talked about it in the beginning of my last podcast. Could this be just a prequel to what's going to happen after the verdict? But no, we got a guilty verdict. And I had said two podcasts ago that I didn't believe that the defense had proved their case. And if I was on the jury, that I probably would have voted not guilty. But I did see some evidence that was in cross-examination during the defense presentation of their case, that it was the most compelling evidence that I had seen in the trial against Chauvin. And I predicted after seeing that Chauvin would be convicted. But a lot of people were saying that it wasn't the evidence that got the convictions. Many people were saying that it was the threat of violence and the threat of the riots and the lootings and all of the stuff that we experienced last summer, that is what influenced the jury. I don't know what influenced the jury and how they came to their conclusion. I know what I saw in the trial. And like I said, I saw some compelling evidence against. I'll tell you what that was. It was they played a video during the defense cross-examination where one of the officers who was a rookie. He was one of the earlier officers who were trying to get George Floyd in the car when Chauvin walked up. And he was a rookie, had just come out of training, and they were trained that once you have subdued a suspect in that prone position, that you roll them over. And the rookie officer asked Chauvin, do you want to roll them over? And Chauvin said, no, we'll leave him like this. For me, that was compelling because they were trained to roll them over out of the prone position. And the rookie officer, you know, showing that he did pay attention during training, said, do you want to roll him over? And Chauvin said, no, we'll leave him like this. I still think that George Floyd was having breathing problems, falling asleep at his in his car. He had the fentanyl in his system, along with the meth. Who knows if it was enough to kill him, but he was complaining of breathing problems before he was down on the ground. He very well could have been having a drug overdose, but keeping him in that prone position, not necessarily even the knee on the neck that looked so violent, and everyone was looking at the knee on the neck as what it could have done, but just simply the prone position by itself. I think that failing and even answering the other officer and saying, no, we're going to leave him like this when the officer. So, I mean, but like I said, two podcasts ago, that's just my opinion. I'm not emotionally attached to Derek Chauvin, this trial, or anything. But a lot of people are. And a lot of people were threatening violence and continuing the riots and the burning and the looting if Derek Chauvin was found innocent. Let's get into these clips. This very first clip that I want to play is a clip of Bill Maher from his show, his opening monologue on Friday night. And he actually says what I just said, but he's making jokes about it, particularly about the looting. And I think it's interesting that he's making jokes about this, the fact that the threat or the air of the threat, the feeling of the threat, the mood of the threat is what we were all on edge about. And even the jury felt that threat and that air of the threat and the mood of the threat of violence. Take a listen to Bill Maher.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for being in a good mood. Yes, well, look, we're not going to have a riot. So people are in a good mood. We thought we were, you know. Well, the good news in the Derek Chauvin trial, they found him guilty. So there was justice for George Floyd. The bad news, if you want something at Foot Locker this weekend, you're going to have to buy it with money. That's
it's funny. It's funny because it's true. It's a little looting humor. But what he's expressing is that there's good news. He says the very first thing he says is that there's good news. There's not going to be any riots this year. We don't have to worry about any riots. And then he moves on and says that the reason that there's not going to be any riots is because Derek Chauvin was found guilty. So he is letting you know that the riots were connected to the verdict. Everyone understood that the riots were connected to the verdict. This is a interview that they did in Minneapolis with some young adults, and this is a group of adults. I just want you to hear what this kid said. Take a listen.
It's a step, but I feel like it was more of a strategic move. Oh, we're gonna give them what they want so that we can put the communities at ease, because we're burning this down.
We'll burn it down is what he says. He says it was a strategy to the verdict, the guilty verdicts that were handed down on Derek Chauvin. They were a strategy. It didn't have anything to do with the law or the evidence, even though many people believe that the video evidence was open and shut and compelling. But what is being expressed is that the threat of the violence, of burning the city down, is what, and many people are stating this outright, is that that's what influenced the verdict, okay?
So that we can put the communities at ease, because we're burning this down.
So when you say burn it down, you might turn people off to what you're saying.
I don't agree with, like, you know, a lot of stuff, but to give us what we want, we'll take action.
We'll take actions if you don't give us what we want. And what we want is Chauvin's head on a platter. What he's saying.
What we want, we'll take action. Words, people have been speaking for years. Martin Luther King Jr., mm-hmm. Malcolm X. We didn't even have people try to, like, run from, you know what I mean? Like, speaking ain't going to do nothing. So then when we show action, what do you get? A guilty verdict.
You get to get guilty verdict because we show action. So what that guy just said, what Bill Maher was saying, is that the threat of the violence was there if the verdict was not the right verdict. Okay, here's another clip. This is a young activist that was outside of the courthouse when the verdict was read, along with a large group of people who were prepared if the verdict was not the verdict that they wanted. And listen to what she says, how they were prepared. Take a listen.
Some here had come prepared for the worst. There's a lot of people with backpacks on, and it's not because we came from school. Because
she says there's a lot of people with backpacks on, and it's not because we came from school. These people are outside of the courthouse, crowds of them outside of the courthouse as the verdict is being read. And in this piece, they say that some people came prepared for the worst. And she says that a lot of people here with backpacks. They have backpacks, and it's not because we came from school. Take a listen.
Some here had come prepared for the worst.
There's a lot of people with backpacks on, and it's not because we came from school. It's because we are ready for either outcome. So I have, like, goggles. I've got really thick furry mittens that block a lot of the tear gas out. Extra mittens for people who might not have any. Another pair of leggings and a shirt.
That's what's in her backpack. I wonder what's in some of these other backpacks because they're ready. They're ready. If they didn't get the verdict that they wanted, then they were prepared to, as the guy said, burn it down. Greg Gutfeld from Fox News, he understood. He got the message. Take a listen to what he said. He was happy about the verdict. I'm glad that Derek Chauvin was found guilty. Take a listen to why.
And now I'm going to just get really selfish. I'm glad that he was found guilty on all charges.
Yeah.
Even if he might not be guilty of all charges.
Oh, my God.
I am glad that he is guilty of all charges because I want a verdict that keeps this country from going up in flames.
Uh-uh.
Oh, my goodness.
No.
What do you mean?
That's honest talk, man. Be honest. I mean, a lot of people in this country felt that way. Felt after what we experienced last year and saw on our televisions last year and the mayhem, you know, compounded with dealing with China virus and everything else. There are a lot of people who were just like, I mean, if we got to lock this guy up to have some peace, lock him up.
Greg, listen.
What do you mean? No, I'm at least being honest. My neighborhood was looted.
Greg,
I don't ever want to go through that again.
We do not sacrifice individuals.
Yes, we do. We sacrifice individuals. That's what we do. A lot of people felt that way. Just give me a guilty verdict. I don't care. I just don't want to have to deal with what we dealt with last year. And we were already got a little taste of it because of the Dante Wright thing that, you know, happened. He was shot by a police officer who says she was thought she was firing her taser. And they were already rioting and looting and confrontations with the police. They were giving you a taste. We talked about it in my last podcast, giving you a taste of what to expect if there's not a guilty verdict. And a lot of Americans just didn't want to deal with that. Just lock him up. That's what we have to do. Then you've all heard the story now of Maxine Waters, congresswoman from California. She's been in Congress for 40 years now. She goes to Minnesota, not her state at all, but she goes there to, you know, encourage the protesters there on the streets who, like I said, were rioting, looting, violent confrontations with the police there in Brooklyn City, just 10 miles away from where the trial was going on there in Minneapolis. And I just want you to understand what was going on there in Minnesota, in Brooklyn City, when Maxine Waters shows up and encourages them to do more of this. This is the then chief of police of Brooklyn City, I keep calling it Brooklyn City. It's Brooklyn Center. This is the then chief of police of Brooklyn Center, and he's now retired. But this is what was going on in those protests when Maxine Waters shows up and says, we need more of this.
And then also, sure. One final question. What was your decision to issue a dispersal order while they were peacefully protesting in front of the police station?
Peaceful.
What led to you to issue a dispersal order, and then on the back end of that 10-minute dispersal order, then to issue out CO2 canisters and gas for the crowd.
So,
can you talk to us about that?
Just so everybody's clear, I was front and center at the protest, at the riot. We did not.
They get mad at him. They get mad at him for saying that it was a riot. I was at the protest riot. And then they start yelling at him. Don't call it a riot. Don't call it a riot. It was a riot. Listen to this. I saw it on TV myself.
We did not.
Don't do that. There was no riot.
There was.
Yeah, it was a riot. I saw it on TV.
We were being, the officers that were putting themselves in harm's way were being pelted with frozen cans of pop. They were being belted with concrete blocks. And yes, we had our helmets on and we had other protective gear, but an officer was injured, hit in the head with a brick. That was a Hennepin County deputy. He was transported to the hospital.
So wow. Hit in the head with the brick transfer. I mean, good thing he's not Capitol Police of the U.S. Capitol, because, I mean, then, you know, Democrats would care. He's just a lowly police officer of Brooklyn Center or a deputy of the sheriff's department, and they crack a brick over his head, and that's fine. He's not Capitol Police, but that was what they were, you know, contesting, that that he is using the word riot to describe. Sounds like a riot to me. And then they're mad that they use tear gas to disperse them when they're there at the police station throwing bricks. We all saw the video of the guy holding the can of soup. He needs all can of soup for my family. And the coward in the media who's interviewing him says, "Oh, you're not going to throw that at anyone, are you?" And he says, "No, it's a can of soup for my family." And he winks at the camera, and she doesn't say anything else to him. Just like, "Oh yeah, so that must be really a can of soup for your family." So that's the environment that sitting Congresswoman Maxine Waters steps on when she comes into Minnesota. Just 10 miles away, and the jury's not sequestered. So, you know, they're breathing this that is just going on 10 miles away. It's national news that this kid was shot, you know, as closing arguments are going on or getting ready to happen in the Derek Chauvin trial. And we're closing this up and ending up the week before we are expected to give this whole trial to the jury and then make a decision just 10 miles away. There is all of this rioting and looting and everything going on. And then this sitting member of Congress comes in on the scene, and this is what Maxine Waters says.
I am very hopeful, and I hope that we're going to get a verdict that is say guilty, guilty, guilty. And if we don't...
You got guilty, 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 Maxine, because that's what you wanted.
I am very
hopeful. That's what you threatened. That you threatened to get, if we don't get guilty, 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 then we want more, more, more of what was going on. And what was going on was looting, violent confrontations with the police, cracking police over the head with bricks, all the stuff that you saw in every city last year. And it was not only there in Brooklyn Center. It was all over the week before the trial, letting you know that this is what's going to happen if we don't get the verdict that we want. She steps on the scene and she is saying that we want a guilty, guilty, guilty verdict. And if we don't get it, then you know what's going to happen.
I am very hopeful, and I hope that we're going to get a verdict that is say guilty, guilty, guilty. And if we don't, we cannot go away.
And not just manslaughter, right? I mean...
Oh, no, not manslaughter. No, no, no.
Not manslaughter. Manslaughter is the charge that makes the most sense. And if she sits here and says that it's murder one, like anyone can say, if you watch that trial, that Derek Chauvin set out to kill George Floyd. That was his intention. No one can say that, but she says it here.
guilty for murder. I don't know whether it's in the first degree, but as far as I'm concerned, it's first degree.
First degree is first degree concern.
Get what you just told. What should the people do? What should protesters on the street do?
What should the protesters on the streets do? Now, what were the protesters were already doing? You just heard the chief of police there cracking police over the head with bricks, throwing other things at them, violent confrontations with the police, looting. They looted the Foot Locker, like Bill Maher said in his joke. That really happened. They looted other stores. They were setting the place on fire. And Maxine Waters shows up as this is going on. And what should the people on the streets do if we don't get the verdict? Guilty, 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 like you said. Murder won. What should they do?
What happens if we do not get what you just told? What should the people do? What should protesters on the street do?
I didn't hear you.
What happens?
What should protesters do?
Well, we got to stay on the street.
Stay on the street.
And we've got to get more active.
More active.
We've got to get more confrontational.
More confrontational.
We've got to make sure that they know that we mean business.
Make sure they know that we mean business. Now, Donald Trump was impeached for that. You know, he told his supporters that we gotta fight for our country, and they were like, you know, it's MMA over here. He said, fight. It's mixed martial arts. He's talking about karate. He took his words out of context, you know, but I mean. I would like to hear someone make case for, you know, a different context, you know, which they're already looting. They're already, you know, committing acts of violence against the police, violent confrontations. They're full on riots, even though they object to calling the riots that they're doing riots. There were riots. And she goes out there and says, we need more. We need to get more active, more confrontational. Know what kind of context you think that is, but there was something else that she said that I think was more important that didn't get a lot of play as she was there speaking to the crowd in Minnesota. And take a listen to this. This is something that is more important because this is the gist of everything going on right now. The race wars they're trying to start, the violence that I think they're trying to get kicked off for this summer, the riots and everything that I think that they're determined to get kicked off, all of the civil unrest. It's all about what Maxine Waters says here. Take a listen.
And Babs, yeah, go ahead, Babs.
I'm gonna stick my mic in here and see if you guys can pick up some of what she's saying.
I want you to know how to get power. All right, she sticks the mic in there and gets a good listen to what she's saying to the crowd there. I want y'all to know how to get power.
If you guys can pick up some of what she's saying.
I want you to know how to get power and how to be in control. The way to get in control is not to allow them to win. You've got to register, and you've got to vote, and you've got to take the power.
Yeah.
Hear that? That's what it's about, people. It's about power. And control, and taking power is what Maxine told the crowd there. Well, I'm sure you are also aware that this came part of the Derek Chauvin trial. Derek Chauvin's attorney had requested that the jury be sequestered at the beginning of the trial. The judge denied that motion, which meant that the jury was going home every night. You know, who knows how close they lived, you know, to Brooklyn Center and everything that was going on there. But when that erupted, the violence and riots and everything in Brooklyn Center, which was just, you know, 10 miles away, it was national news. and Chauvin's attorney. Actually, I think that he either put in a motion at that time for the jury to be sequestered, or he called for a mistrial. And it doesn't matter because neither were granted. So the judge just said, you know, well, I've informed them not to watch the news. How the hell are you going to inform them not to watch the news? This is happening in their backyard. You know, it's crazy. It's 10 miles away and it's national news. There's civil unrest, disturbance with the police, rioting, looting, burning. Don't watch the news. But when this Maxine Waters thing happened, that gave Chauvin's attorney a little bit more fuel. He asked for a mistrial again, and in that, that's when it became a big part of the trial because the judge admitted that Maxine Waters, a sitting member of Congress, and her statements in stirring up the crowd for a particular verdict may have given Chauvin some ammo in appeal.
And now that we have U.S. representatives threatening acts of violence in relation to this specific case, it's mind-boggling to me, Judge.
Well, I'll give you that Congresswoman Waters may have given you something on appeal. I'm aware that Congresswoman Waters was talking specifically about this trial and about the unacceptability of anything less than a murder conviction.
Murder one.
About being confrontational, but you can submit the press articles about that. This goes back to what I've been saying from the beginning. I wish elected officials would stop talking about this case, especially in a manner that is disrespectful to the rule of law and to the judicial branch and our function. I think if they want to give their opinions, they should do so in a respectful and in a manner that is consistent with their oath to the Constitution to respect a co-equal branch of government. Their failure to do so, I think, is abhorrent, but I don't think it has prejudiced us with an additional material that would prejudice this jury. They have been told not to watch the news. I trust they are following those instructions and that there is not in any way a prejudice to the defendant beyond the articles that we're talking specifically about the facts of this case.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous what he's saying. And he's to blame, too, because he should have sequestered the jury in the beginning. And he is going to be, I think, when this is all said and done, part of the blame if Chauvin does get a mistrial on appeal. Because how are you going to just tell the jury, oh, don't watch the news? Especially when the fire is breaking out in your backyard. You know, you can just walk outside and just talk to your neighbor and hear about what's going on in Brooklyn Center, or just, I mean, go to a coffee shop or to the grocery store and be influenced by what's going on just 10 miles away from where you are. You can't watch sports because sports is all political now. All they do is talk about it. Can't watch Sports Center because all they do is talk about it. Shows like this propaganda on ABC, Station 19. It's a show about a firehouse. This was the opening of the program last week, Station 19 on ABC. Take a listen.
I know it's been a long night, team, and we have a long shift ahead of us, but I want you all to...
Brian.
Jack. Don't worry. I got a rapid test this morning, so...
That's a little a COVID material there. Don't worry, I got a rapid test this morning, because she walks in and everybody is freaking out, or they're looking at her with suspicion. She's like, don't worry, I got a rapid test this morning.
I know.
And it's funny, if you watch this propaganda, everything is in there. Everything that they are trying to spin on you, it is all commingled and written into these narratives because you're being propagandized, even when that's what I'm showing you, that the judge's order telling jurors not to watch the news, it was irrelevant because they can't watch anything. You're being propagandized across all mediums. Everything that is being projected at you across all mediums is to propagandize you.
Long night, team, and we have a long shift ahead of us, but I want you all to...
Brian.
Jack, don't worry. I got a rapid test this morning, so I'm clean as a whistle.
I
asked her to come. There's been a death, and you are all grieving, so I asked her to come. I'm sorry,
you're talking about George Floyd?
You brought in a therapist to help us process the death of George Floyd.
I did. I feel powerless to help, and this felt like something I could do.
I mean, it's absolute crap. You know, listen to this stuff. This is another part of the program.
Anything to work so hard to get them to stand tall and feel good in their own skin, only to then have to tell them that because of the color of that skin, they have to shrink when in the presence of a police officer.
Do you tell them that?
It's hilarious. So the judge didn't sequester the jury and told them, you know, just don't watch the news. And I guess that was enough. We'll see on appeal. But even the attorney general of the state, what's his name? Keith Ellison. I was former Congress person that had the seat that Ilhan Omar has now. Even he's interviewed here by CNN, and he admits to the fact that he is concerned about appeal. And take a listen here.
Moving forward, are you worried about an appeal?
Well, look, any case is going to be appealed. You asked the critical question, am I worried about it? I'm sufficiently... concerned, because I need to be. You know, we're not going to get careless, but I feel that the trial was solid and it was fair, and that Derek Chauvin had an opportunity for a full and fair trial.
Were you concerned at all when the comments from Congresswoman Maxine Waters not only got the attention of Judge Cahill, but really caught his anger, as we saw play out as part of the court proceedings?
Well, I'm a firm believer in the First Amendment. I mean, and I
unless
know
it's Donald
Waters,
Trump.
My committee.
I believe in the First Amendment unless it's Donald Trump. Maxine Waters gets the First Amendment, but Donald Trump don't get the First Amendment. Donald Trump tells his supporters to fight for their country, and he gets impeached. Maxine Waters steps into an environment that is a powder keg, where all kinds of civil unrest is going on. And she says, if we don't get the verdict we want more of that. We want more activity, more confrontation. And nothing happens to her. And do you notice what's going on? I notice. But it's not about the First Amendment. It's not about the First Amendment at all. And Alan Dershowitz, it's funny, I'm approaching my 100th episode. Alan Dershowitz was a lawyer that I played a lot in my very first episode. I played a clip of Alan Dershowitz, and I think that I've played tons of clips from him giving legal analysis a lot. I love his legal analysis. He is right on the money quite often. And I love the fact that when all the Russia investigation was going on and everything, and that's what I played in my first episode, when we were talking about, you know, the whole Russia investigation and spies and the Trump campaign, and how Alan Dershowitz, who has been a Democrat, a civil libertarian his entire life, stood up for the rule of law and spoke out on how wrong that was. And he's, you know, been a pariah in his own party ever since. But he gives solid legal analysis, and he does so here. Take a listen.
Well, thank you. You know, I rarely make predictions, but I'm going to make a prediction now, and I know it will be shown again in a year or a year and a half when I claim my prediction will come true. I predict the United States Supreme Court will reverse this conviction, will certainly take seriously the reversal of this conviction, and ironically, it will base the reversal on cases growing out of Ku Klux Klan, when in the 1920s and the 1930s and the first decade of the 20th century, political leaders, much like Maxine Waters, of course, on the other side, and much less credible and having much less of a moral claim, but political leaders led protests outside.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Maxine Waters doesn't have any moral claim. I mean, he's relating it to trials in the 60s where in small towns, the jury was influenced by crowds of white people, racists out in front of the courthouses that, you know, were basically demanding that the jury do their bidding. And the Supreme Court, he has the case law. This guy is an excellent attorney. He's a professor that teaches law at one of the most prestigious universities in the country. He has the case law, and cases were overturned in the 60s when he says, ironically, the Ku Klux Klan and races were influencing juries to do their will. And he says that Nancy, or not Nancy Pelosi, but the same vein, Maxine Waters has it's on the opposite side, and she has more of a moral high ground. I'm not sure that that's necessarily true.
Having much less of a moral claim, but political leaders led protests outside of courtrooms that had racially charged trials, and they influenced juries, and they made threats. Basically, if the jury were to acquit an African-American man or convict a white man, there would be repercussions. And courts, including the Supreme Court, have reversed convictions based on that. And I think what Maxine Waters did and said, coupled with what others said before that, and coupled with the judge's refusal to sequester the jury from the beginning, and his weak instruction just not to listen to the news, I think will be enough to reverse any conviction in this case. The judge has hinted at that. I think the judge is right. So stay tuned. This case will not end with this jury verdict. I don't think the Court of Appeals in Minnesota will have the courage to reverse this conviction based
on... Supreme Court's not going to have the courage. It was rumored that the reason that the Supreme Court didn't take up the Texas case in during the election when Texas sued and all those other states joined Texas to sue the states that had changed their election laws outside of the state legislature and the Supreme Court, it was rumored. Someone said that an aide or someone heard... Chief Justice Roberts saying that there's riots and there's violence and mobs out in the streets. We're not going to overturn the election because we're afraid of the mob. So the Minnesota Supreme Court is not going to have the courage to overturn this conviction, but neither is the Supreme Court. I'm just showing you what Alan Dershowitz is saying. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that if the mobs in the streets are influencing juries, if they're influencing the court system, if they have that much influence on the street, the mob on the street is running this country.
Grounds, but I think the United States Supreme Court may well do that.
If they do, Professor, I'm curious to get your thoughts as to whether or not they may draw on another big case. I heard you mention it. It's a case I am fascinated with, the Shepard case. Do you think that
Shepard,
that case could be grounds? Should this case go all the way up for appeal, that case all about the court's duty to, you know, protect a defendant's right to a fair trial and insulate them from the media exposure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was litigated by my friend and colleague, Effley Bailey, who was my co-counsel, in the O.J. Simpson case. But there were many other cases as well, cases involving racial issues in the South, where jurors clearly were threatened, where the sword of Damocles hung over their head, where a message was being sent. Remember, when the Klan had these protests in front of the courthouse, they would have elected attorneys general, elected mayors. They would have ministers. They would have very prominent people.
The pressure and the threat is palpable. That we'll find out who you are. We'll know where you live. We're coming after you. If we don't get the verdict that we want, guilty, 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 we'll get more active. We'll get more confrontational. We'll turn up the heat.
The threat. And what Maxine Waters did, although she's on the right side of the racial issue and the Klan was on the wrong side of the racial issue, in terms of...
Give her
of
that.
Tactic,
I mean, if you say. But she's a... I mean, she's a racist, too. I mean, I don't even know that Maxine Waters is a racist. She just wants power, like she says. I'm not going to even call her a racist. So maybe he's right on that. Maybe that I would say that Maxine Waters is on the right side of the racial issue. But it doesn't matter. It's still putting pressure on the jury to give the verdict that the mob wants. It's mob rule.
Was on the wrong side of the racial issue. In terms of the tactic, is right out of the playbook of the Ku Klux Klan, and that's what's so disturbing and ironic when you have a civil rights leader like Waters using the tactic of the Klan to try to influence the jury. And, you know, the idea that she incited violence, that's secondary. The
violence
is
already going on. She just said do more. The violence was already happening because of the shooting of the Dante Wright, and then she stepped on the scene and said, we need to do more if we don't get the verdict that we want.
Using the tactic of the Klan to try to influence the jury. And, you know, the idea that she incited violence, that's secondary. The primary thing is she intended to have an influence on this jury's deliberations. She told them, we will not accept the manslaughter verdict. We want a murder conviction. And if you come back with a manslaughter conviction, we will be confrontational and go to the streets. I do think personally, having seen the entire trial and watched the evidence and looked at the evidence, that probably the justice verdict in this case, based on the evidence and the law, would be for manslaughter in the third degree and the second degree, but not murder in the second or third degree.
Murder one is what she said. She wants murder one is what she said.
With murder or with manslaughter, but you have this threat. If you come back with manslaughter, if you look at the evidence and come to the conclusion that no, there wasn't felony murder under the second degree murder, no, there were no threats to others under third degree murder, and you come to your own conclusion based on justice, believing that manslaughter is the right verdict, there will be consequences to you, to your family, to your schools, to your businesses,
your neighborhood, to your city.
One of the witnesses in the case who testified.
The threat was palpable. Everybody knew that was the threat, that if you do not give the verdict that we want, we're going to burn it down. I played the clips of them saying it.
Had what was his former home, but they thought it was his home, covered with blood and other kinds of threats. The lawyers have received threats. Others have received threats. The air of violence is prominent, and the jury breathes that air. There is no way the jurors don't know about Maxine Waters' statement. There is no way they don't know about the statements of Sharpton and others. There's no way that the protests outside the courtroom have not gotten into the jury box. You know what defense lawyers say? When you throw a skunk in the jury box, you can get rid of the skunk, but you can't get rid of the smell. And the smell of violence is in that jury room now as the jury is deliberating.
So he's absolutely right about that. And that was an interview that he gave on the morning that the verdict was reached. They only deliberated for 10 hours. This is Hawk Newsom, and he is a Black Lives Matter leader in Brooklyn, New York. And he makes it very clear everything that I've said in the first part of this podcast. He crystallizes it here. Take a listen.
You look at Eric Garner. People did all of the same things without the destruction of property. What kind of message does America send into the people? like, we'll ignore you until you cause massive disruptions. Then we'll give you your justice. That America doesn't listen to us when we march peacefully. I'm not saying people will be back in the street, but America must know that if you continue to allow us to be murdered in the streets without justice, we will raise hell in America.
Oh, it can't get any clearer than that. He says that's the message. The message is, when we marched and did things peaceful, when it was Eric Garner and other situations where it was peaceful and we didn't riot and we didn't loot, we didn't get justice. And, you know, now we got the guilty verdict that we wanted, but even that's not justice. I don't know if you've heard this propaganda narrative, but that this isn't justice. This is only accountability. Justice comes later when there is a world where this never happens again. That's the justice. So everyone got to take a breath and say, wow, we're not going to have riots. We're not going to have looting. We gave you guys what you wanted. There is some theories that even if there were some holdouts on the jury for a hung jury that didn't really feel that that murder two or murder three, that he was actually guilty on those or whatever, that the judge in the case saying that Chauvin had some ammo on appeal because of the violence and people talking about the case, like Maxine Waters, that if you're on the jury, rather than be that lone standout for a hung jury or lone standout against some of these more severe charges, you go ahead and go along with everybody on the jury and you say guilty because you have an out. Chauvin has an out on appeal. Who knows? Just speculating. But regardless, you have the guilty verdict and everybody does a sigh of relief and celebrates. All the celebration is going on. And while the celebration is going on, 16-year-old girl in Ohio is shot by the police in an incident where she has a knife in her hand. Both of the girls are black. She's getting ready to stab another black girl. And the officer rolls up on the scene, sees her about to stab another girl, and then shoots her, puts four bullets in her, and she ended up dying. And everybody was trying to use that to kick off, you know, more of the riots and the violence, and to carry on that energy from the Dante Wright riots the week before. And the video came out, the steel shot that went viral of the one girl, Makaya Bryant, with her arm back with the knife in her hand, ready to stab when the shots are rang out. Like, who knows if she could have hit an artery or something and killed the girl who was getting ready to get stabbed. And there was some controversy even on the left. You know, even CNN had come out, and Don Lemon came out and said that the officer was justified in the shooting, that he saved a life. And there were still a lot of people trying to make it a racial issue. The poor young black girl dead, and she was getting ready to kill someone. There's this other video that came out later after LeBron James tweets the officer's picture out with, it says on the top of the tweet, "You're next, accountability." And it's a picture of the officer that saved this girl's life. He ends up deleting the tweet because he's an absolute idiot. And there's another camera angle before, it came out after all the controversy, another camera angle from the house across the street that shows when the officer pulls up in his car, he gets out of the car, Micaiah is coming out of the house and sees the officer. I mean, the police are there. If you called the police, if you wanted the police to come and save you, these girls were about to jump you. Why is it when the police pulled up, that's when you decide to run after the girl and say, I'm going to stab you? Anyway, LeBron James, dumbass, tweets the officer his picture out with your next accountability, and everybody thought that this is it. You know, this Micaiah Bryant's next. We're going to get accountability. Ohio, everybody's going to Ohio. That's where the next protest is, where we're going to start the riots. And, you know, once the video came out, and even CNN and a lot on the left were saying, look, man, this looks justified. This looks like, you know, that you don't have anything here. I want to play this clip of Marcellus Wiley and his criticisms of LeBron James, which LeBron James got a lot of criticism for his dumbass tweet. But take a listen to Marcellus Wiley here.
You can't be that irresponsible if you're LeBron James because you have that much power. And we all know when you get that type of power, the responsibility comes with it. The accountability that was deleted in that tweet is ironic. Like, to put up hashtag accountability, which is something that we all need right now in this moment. Accountability on all sides with all people. Whether you're talking about the police officers, whether you're talking about the individuals in this situation, or even the victim in this situation. Every situation with accountability, not just rooting interests. And that's what's interesting about this. LeBron James, in terms of what he does for his day job, being a basketball player, second best at worst ever, maybe the GOAT.
He's not the GOAT.
There's one glaring critique on his resume that he defers.
And that's why he's not the GOAT. That's why he's not the GOAT. Because Magic Johnson never deferred. Kobe Bryant never deferred. Michael Jordan, well, Magic Johnson was a point guard, so he would defer sometimes in clutch situations. Kobe didn't defer in clutch situations. Michael Jordan didn't defer in clutch situations, and that is a criticism of LeBron James, is that he defers. He passes the ball in clutch situation, and Marcellus Wiley says here is that that's what you should have done in this situation. You should have passed.
One glaring critique on his resume that he defers. In critical times. Damn, I wish that was true in this moment. When it's a real issue, not just basketball wins and losses and points scored. When it's real life issues, where's the deferring? In that moment, LeBron, until all the facts come out, till you watch the video, till you come out and see what's right from wrong in this situation, he should have passed in this moment.
He should have passed. He should have passed. But LeBron James wanted to play the race bait game and make it about race, and he didn't have all the facts, and he should have passed. Well, the Micaiah Bryant thing kind of fizzled out. There's still some that are holding out that they can make something out of the Micaiah Bryant. Or they just lump her in. I've heard them doing that, just lumping Micaiah Bryant in with all the others and saying we got to get justice for this group. But another reason that LeBron James should have passed is because as things are happening and this new issue with this Andrew Brown guy in North Carolina, as different events come about, LeBron James can't speak on them. Where, you know, the facts may be different in another situation like this Andrew Brown situation. I don't know what the facts are. Nobody knows what the facts are in this case because the facts are being hidden from the family, from the world, from all of us. And we could really use LeBron James in this case, you know, his notoriety, his celebrity. Instead of just firing off, you know, half cocked with not knowing what's going on and basically using all your ammo, he hasn't said anything about Andrew Brown. He can't say anything about Andrew Brown because he doesn't have any credibility, and he was roasted so hard because of the Micaiah Bryant issue. But this Andrew Brown issue, this thing does have the legs. That there's some fishy stuff going on in this situation, and it would be nice to be able to hear from LeBron on this. But take a listen to this clip about what's going on with this guy Andrew Brown in North Carolina.
His family need answers.
Tonight, family members preparing to see Andrew Brown Jr.'s final moments after he was shot and killed by Pasquotank County Sheriff's deputies.
The family is ready to see this body cam footage, but I'm hopeful that we can get to a resolution so this video can be shown tomorrow at 11:30.
But there is no guarantee?
Nothing's guaranteed.
This comes after days of growing pressure on the sheriff to release a video. He said he'll put in a formal request Monday.
Because we want transparency, we want the body camera footage made public.
Under North Carolina law, the body camera film video can only be released with the approval of a Superior Court judge.
So how soon could the judge okay the release of the footage? Could it be in a matter of hours? Could it be days?
It could be in a matter of hours. It's up to the judge.
So that was on Sunday. The judge did allow for the release, but they only released 20 seconds is what we're told. They haven't released anything to the public. 20 seconds of one angle of body camera, and there were multiple officers there, just like in the Derek Chauvin trial. We had multiple angles from multiple officers who were there that we saw during the trial. There were multiple angles, multiple officers all wearing body cameras, and they released to the family one angle, which is 20 seconds. They had promised to do it at 11 o'clock North Carolina time, and then they pushed it off and said that, you know, we're not going to be able to do it at 11. We have to redact some of the images in the video. Redact means black out some of the images in the video, and they ended up showing the one video, and it's only 20 seconds. And this is so fishy. But like I said in the beginning of this podcast, they are determined to get the riots started. And this Andrew Brown story, it has the legs because it is fishy. The sheriff's department is not being fully forthcoming. And as they continue to hide the rest of the video and all the other information about this killing, then the tension starts to rise. People are already going into North Carolina. They had protests all night last night. They're having protests tonight, and this has the legs. Let's listen to more about what the charges were on Andrew Brown and what we know about what's going on with this.
Years ago, deputies were attempting to serve Brown a search and arrest warrant on felony drug charges.
Felony drug charges. Something very interesting that this all dates back to the war on drugs. And, you know, I have a clip of this C-SPAN call. I listened to quite a bit of call-ins. You know, the C-SPAN line where they call in different numbers for independents, different numbers for Democrats, different numbers for Republicans. I don't know, on the day after the Chauvin verdict, they did 3 hours of calls, and I don't even think that they you know, separated people by party, that everyone was just calling one number. And man, there were some, I mean, the American people are not stupid. A lot of people in America know what's going on, but there were some outstanding calls in that program, and I'll put it in the show notes, but I'm going to play some of the calls. One of the calls I want to play is this lady, and she reminds us, and I've told you about this in this podcast, about the origins of the war on drugs. And take a listen to this caller into C-SPAN and how she reminds you what I've told you about the origins of the war on drugs, which Joe Biden was, for the past 40 years, he has been front and center on the war on drugs. Still to this day, he is waging the war on drugs. Just to let you know that this system of systemic racism that he is now complaining about, he built the structure.
Well, we have a long way to go still, but I just want to read something very quickly from John Ehrlichman. The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. John Ehrlichman, Nixon. I was
John Ehrlichman. I remember I told you about that quote. In that, I did a series of podcasts about Nixon, the war on drugs, how the war on drugs started, how the CIA started shipping in the drugs, how the drugs created the crime, how Joe Biden authored the crime bill, how the whole system was built. And this caller, I was rather shocked when this caller called in the C-SPAN, and she was talking about the George Floyd verdict and other things as well. But she read that, and I don't even know why she read that, because even though George Floyd was a drug addict and he had a problem with drugs, just like Hunter Biden, I mean, Hunter Biden too, but Hunter Biden gets book deals. He doesn't get shot like Andrew Brown and what happens to George Floyd and what happened to black people under the system that Joe Biden built. That's what I don't understand. I did all of those podcasts and those series of podcasts before the election, because I was trying to show people, particularly black people, about who you were voting for. Because this is Joe Biden now. This is what Joe Biden is saying about systemic racism and George Floyd and all that. He's got a whole new song and dance now complaining about systemic racism, but he was there. He built the system. He's been there 45 years. It is his system. Take a listen to what Joe Biden said the other day in response to the verdict.
Jury in Minnesota found former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts in the murder of George Floyd last May. It was a murder in the full light of day, and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see the systemic racism the vice president just referred to.
Systemic racism.
Systemic racism is a stain on our nation's soul.
Systemic racism, the knee stain on, the neck on our soul,
of
on our
justice
nation's
for
soul.
Black Americans. Profound fear and trauma, the pain, the exhaustion that black and brown Americans experience every single day. The murder of George Floyd launched a summer of protest we hadn't seen since the civil rights era in the 60s. Protests that unified people of every race and generation in peace and with purpose to say enough, enough, enough of the senseless killings.
Oh, enough of the senseless killings, huh? enough of the senseless killings. I mean, so this was on April 20th. You can go to Black Lives Matter Twitter page and see that on April 20th, Black Lives Matter tweeted, Biden is currently sending more military equipment to our neighborhoods than Trump did. You read that right. You heard that right. That came from me. You heard that right. Our communities are being terrorized at a greater rate than they had been under Trump. That comes from Black Lives Matter. And it's 100% true. Just like under Obama, Obama was sending military equipment to the neighborhoods and militarizing the neighborhoods because that's who they are. Joe Biden's doing the same thing, sending military equipment to cities and neighborhoods. And he's sitting here talking about systemic racism while he's still funding the drug war. And he's supported the drug war his whole life, which is war on black people, but not Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden gets book deals. Hunter Biden gets sweetheart deals working for petroleum companies in Ukraine when he doesn't have any experience. And he's a drug addict, but he doesn't get what Andrew Brown got and get shot when they're coming to raid him on a felony drug charge. No, that's not what happens to Hunter Biden. I mean, let's remember Joe Biden back in the day. The old school Joe Biden. I mean, let's listen to a little bit more of him today, because I want to contrast this nice old man Joe Biden to the Joe Biden back in the day when he was talking about knocking black people upside the head and bringing down the full weight of the law on them. This is Joe Biden today.
Hey, today's verdict is a step forward. I just spoke with the governor of Minnesota. Thank me for the close work with his team. I also spoke with George Floyd's family again. Remarkable family of extraordinary courage.
Take back the streets.
Nothing can
it
ever bring their brother,
or
their father,
that is
back.
Accosting your son or daughter,
but
or my son or daughter, my wife,
forward.
Your husband, my mother, your parents. It doesn't matter whether or not they were deprived as a youth. It doesn't matter or not whether or not they had no background that enabled them to become socialized into the fabric of society. It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask what made them do this. They must be taken off the street.
Must be taken off the streets.
That's number one. There's a consensus on that. Unless we do something about that cadre of young people, tens of thousands of them, born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscience developing, because they literally, I yield myself three more minutes, because they literally have not been socialized. They literally have not had an opportunity. We should focus on them now. If we don't, they will, or a portion of them will, become the predators 15 years from now. And Madam President, we have predators on our streets.
And this guy's talking about systemic racism now. He's talking about systemic racism when he is supporting and sicking the dogs out on people for drug charges. He's still fighting the war on drugs. He is still militarizing local police departments with his DA vice president, who also dropped the hammer. I mean, what did you expect? I have no sympathy for you. I have no sympathy for you if you voted for Joe Biden. Now they want to play the race card and say that it's all about race. And, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with race. It's divide and conquer, people. I've been telling you this. Do you know? Listen to this clip. This is a clip about how wealthy the richest people in the world got over the last 12 months, over the last year of COVID, when everyone was struggling to get by and committing suicide and losing family members, all this heartache and everything. Well, while Americans were losing income in the middle class and lower class businesses, small businesses closing down and everything, the eight richest people in the world, they increased their wealth. Take a listen to this.
A new Oxfam report has revealed how the world's rich are riding out the pandemic in luxury. More than 100 million people are at the risk of extreme poverty. Healthcare workers, market vendors, and small businesses are struggling to pay their bills. It could take more than a decade to return to pre-pandemic poverty levels. But the billionaires have had no such problem. The collective wealth of billionaires rose $3.9 trillion between March and December last year. The 10 richest men saw their wealth increase by $540 billion. This would be enough to lift the entire world out of poverty.
$540 billion is how much the 10 richest men increase in the world, increased their wealth in the past year of China virus and everything. And this is not wealth creation. This is wealth transfer. That's on the global stage. This is in the United States domestically what's going on.
2020, for all its challenges, turned out to be a very good year for the world's richest people. The wealthiest 500 people on the planet added $1.8 trillion to their combined net worth. It's a 31% jump, the biggest yearly gain in the history of the Bloomberg billionaires.
It's wealth transfer.
A lot of those gains had to do with soaring stock markets, benefiting billionaires who have big stakes in very large companies. Case in point, Jeff Bezos. The world's richest person added $77 billion to his net worth this year.
Jeff Bezos adds $77 billion to his net worth. I read an article that said the eight richest families are now worth $1 trillion in collective wealth. This is wealth transfer. This is not wealth creation. At the same time, these guys are getting richer, then you see the middle class getting poorer. The middle class had to shut down their businesses. You had to have Congress sign away over $6 trillion in government stimulus. That stimulus comes from the public treasury. All right. This is wealth transfer. Okay. That's going on. And they have you fighting in the streets over the color of the skin that you were born in and all of these issues. This is nothing more than divide and conquer. I don't understand how I can make you understand this if you don't understand this. These guys are getting rich. They're actually consolidating power. That's why Joe Biden is sending military equipment into neighborhoods and cities still, just like Obama, because they're fortifying their power. They're getting richer. And the police are going to get stronger. You think that you are out in the streets weakening the police force and the system? No, the police force is going to get stronger, more militant in response to what's going on in the streets. And these people, the rich, who are going to be, they live so far away from this stuff. They're just sitting over these cities watching this go on, and they're just getting more rich and more powerful, and you're fighting over the color of the skin you were born in. And I don't understand what I'm watching going on. It has nothing to do with race. Nothing at all. This is another caller into C-SPAN. There were some great calls. I wish I could play more of them, but I'm going to play a few more. This is a caller that called into C-SPAN in their open lines after the Derek Chauvin trial. Take a listen.
To Alan in Caldwell, New Jersey. Good morning. You're next.
Hi, how you doing? You know, I think it's a strange situation we're running ourselves into. The police are going to not want to respond to certain things because they're going to fear that every time they respond to a criminal act of an individual, that they're going to back down and they're just not going to know what to do. And unfortunately, the Democrats just want to keep race baiting everybody. This thing was not about race. It was an incident where an individual was either he
talking about George Floyd,
a counterfeit bill, or he didn't. This was about arresting a man. I don't think cops necessarily chase after black African Americans and want to commit crimes to hurt them. I think what we're headed towards a race war, and I believe that the Democrats are pushing this.
That caller is 100% right. That they are pushing the race war. They're pushing the division based on race. The one thing that they do not want is for black people and white people to come together and to see that they have a common enemy. That's the last thing that they want. And they've used this tape with that this little girl. Now they're praising the little girl for shooting the video of the end of George Floyd's life, and you know, they use that when they could have given us more context, put out more of the police body cam earlier, just like now with what's going on in North Carolina, hiding the video of the body cam. That does nothing but make tensions rise and create a scenario that when the tape finally does come out, I'm talking about North Carolina now, it's going to set these people off. Now in the George Floyd case, this guy that I just played on the C-SPAN call said it didn't have anything to do with race. And nobody who watched that trial can say that it had anything to do with race. That they were trying to get George Floyd into the car, and it escalated, and George Floyd, you know, is dead, and Derek Chauvin is convicted of killing him now. But no one can say that it had anything to do with race, and this is my issue that I want people to understand about me, is that I've never said that we don't have a problem with police or that we're not over policed and we don't live in a police state. I've never said that. That a lot of the police are ruthless. They use ruthless tactics. Joe Biden, Obama sends the military equipment to our local neighborhoods. What do you think's going to happen? You're still engaged in the drug war that does nothing but create more criminality in your neighborhoods, in your cities. Yes, we live in a police state. We not only live in a police state, like Edward Snowden told us and had to flee the country after telling us that you live in a police state. It's an Orwellian police state where you're being watched all the time. And this Orwellian police state wants more power. I've never said that that's not true, that there's bad cops. There's bad people. This is a basic tenet of Christianity, that Christians believe that people are inherently bad. Inherently, from birth, people are bad. I believe people are bad. All people. That's why I don't have any faith in any institutions, because institutions are made up of people. Of course there's bad police. There's bad people. But that's why we need police, because there's bad people. But we need good police, and we need accountability for the police. You know, but it's not about race. It's not like, you know, white people catch less hell from the police. And that's the narrative that they're pushing out. Well, Dylan Roof, they took him alive and gave him Burger King. I don't know about that, you know, the Burger King. I guess that story is true, that they fed him Burger King. There's probably more to that story, but I've seen the video of Dylan Root getting arrested and then pulling his car over and him getting out of the car. As soon as he gets out of the car, he puts his hand on the hood of the car. They come over, they put the handcuffs on him. He doesn't I mean it's on the video, I've seen it, I'll put it in the show notes for you. He doesn't resist one time. You know, and every case has its own facts, but it doesn't have to be about race. It doesn't have to be about race, but they're making it about race because it's divide and conquer. I want you to listen to this next C-SPAN call, and this is a woman out of Oregon. I want you to take a listen to her story.
Tonight, we'll go back to more of your phone calls. Pamela in Eugene, Oregon. Good evening.
Hello. I'm so happy to be on. I've tried for months to get on. I was supposed to get on today. I am so happy about this verdict because I am a 73-year-old woman who believes in democracy, and I believe in justice, and I believe that this man was murdered, and I really did not think they were going to convict. I live in Oregon, and I'm telling you, I really thought that this man was going to go free, and I am just, I'm so happy to come home from my appointments and see it on television that he was convicted, and I do believe that this is a worldwide victory. I really do. The world is watching us now, and they're seeing that we do have the ability to bring justice and peace to the police and the people. I have been brutalized. I'm 73. I was brutalized more than once by police, and I'm a white woman. Not to take away from the color and the people of color that get it so much more, but believe me, I was shocked when I was abused by a black police officer here in Oregon when I was 32 years old.
Wow. A white woman who claims to have been abused, is what she says, by a black police officer in Eugene, Oregon. So, and she says that I don't want to take anything away from black people, where it happens more to black people. It does happen more to black people proportionally. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it happens more actually to white people. But they like to make the claim, well, that's because the population of white people is larger, so that's true. But proportionally, they say that blacks are in more confrontations with the police, but that's because blacks are doing a lot more of the crime. I mean, the areas where the policing is going on is mostly in urban areas where a lot of black people live. And there's a lot of crime in those areas, quite frankly. But, you know, I played that clip because I wanted to play her saying, you know, look, I'm white and I've had run-ins with the police. The police haven't always, you know, been great to me in this police state. Here's another call from C-SPAN. Take a listen.
He had come up from L.A. They sent him up here because he was too brutal in L.A. And he came up to a small town on the coast, and he brutalized me one night. And the irony was I had asked for the police to be called because my van got stuck on the side of the road. And from that, I went to jail and went to court, and I lost. And I'm telling you that this is a victory for everyone. We have gone.
Everyone. Let's include everyone. That is not the second call that I was going to play. That was the lady in Oregon again telling more about the story of the black officer who abused her, and she lost in court, and she feels victimized by what happened to her by this black officer who came up to Oregon from L.A. and abused her. But she says this is a victory for everyone. Include everyone. This has been my problem with Black Lives Matter and the whole idea that this is a black issue from the beginning, because it excludes so many other people who are victimized by bad policing. That if you really want to change things where in policing in the United States, don't just make it a black issue, make it a policing issue, to where if it doesn't matter who you are, if you've been victimized by bad police, then you are welcome to join this movement. But making it Black Lives Matter and that this is a black issue, it's ignorant, and it excludes a lot of people from your movement that could be allies. If the movement is really about bad policing and changing policing in America. That's not what the movement is about. In actuality, talking about Black Lives Matter, and that's why they focused on Black lives and only Black lives killed by police, because even Black Lives Matter don't want to talk about Black lives that are killed by other Black lives. You know, this is propaganda. They're dividing you intentionally, people. All right, here's the next call, C-SPAN call that I wanted to play. Take a listen.
On the side of the road. And from that, I went to jail and went to court, and I lost. And I'm telling you that this is a victory for everyone. We have got to have the police be accountable.
So, Pamela, thank you for based on what you just said, and you answered part of it, is this a pivot point in terms of race relations and the issue?
It's not about race. I'm sorry that I can't get off this call from this woman in Oregon. But, you know, she's talking about the fact how she was abused by the police. And I've had an incident with the police, and I'm a white woman. And this is a victory for everyone. And this guy in the media, C-SPAN, even is turns it right back to race. Is this a victory for race relations? And what does it have to do with race? It's about bad policing and being over-policed in areas, and police thinking they have too much power. That's what it's about. It's not about race.
Accountable.
So, Pamela, based on what you just said, and you answered part of it, is this a pivot point in terms of race relations and the issue of police brutality in our country?
Do I think it is?
Yes. Is it a pivot point?
Yes, I think that there is a definite problem with race relations and the police in our country together. But I'm just here to say that it's also across the board, because I was brutalized, and that was not just once. I've had it happen twice, once in California.
Mm-hmm. It's not just, so he keeps trying to force her into this race thing, and what's she going to say? No, it's not a race thing. But she is saying, she's saying what she wants to say. And also, you know, complying with his mandate to focus on the race. But she's saying, look, no, it's not about race. It's about everyone. This has happened to me more than once, and I'm a white woman, is what she's saying.
I'm just here to say that it's also across the board, because I was brutalized, and that was not just once. I've had it happen twice, once in California. Mm-hmm. Years ago. And if I hadn't had a good public defender then, I don't know what would have happened.
So she's probably a poor white woman who has been victimized by police, just like anybody else who is poor, because, you know, that's what happens in cities where they have bad police, you know, and they have bad policing and, frankly, bad laws. The police become tyrants, and that's what's happening. It's not only happening to Black lives, it's happening to everybody. Okay, here's the second call that I wanted to play from C-SPAN. Take a listen.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing that he did get convicted and he was found guilty. I have had my own experience. I'm a white woman, mm-hmm. and I have had been brutalized by the police. And I think it's a day where people's voices are finally starting to be heard.
Another one. You don't say. Meg from Washington, white woman, has had run-ins with bad police. And she feels left out because everybody's just focused on Black Lives Matter.
And I have had been brutalized by the police. And I think it's a day.
Nobody cares about you, Meg. Nobody cares about the fact that you have had run in with bad police because you are not Black. We only care about Black people and their interactions with police, because it's divide and conquer. Do you see?
Voices are finally starting to be heard. Because I had to bear a false conviction because I was brutalized and forced into pleading out for something I didn't do by an officer who was just brutal.
So Meg, what changes moving forward in your mind? What will change? Not what you want to see change, but what will change?
Nothing. I'll tell you what's going to change. I mean, especially with people in the streets that are falling for this divide and conquer race war action. The rich are going to get richer. The police state is going to get more militant. And they already have the, I don't know if you've seen these robot police that they are, they're basically starting to try out in New York. They're using the little robot dog, but they also have the full robot, RoboCop that they have. I mean, you can see where this is going.
What will change?
Mm-hmm.
I just see that. At least people's voices are being heard, and
your voices are not being heard.
Reform, so that they will be held accountable. They won't be able to perpetrate these kind of crimes on people. In my case, it wasn't murder, but my whole life collapsed because I was forced into the system by a brutal cop. But I don't.
It's happening every day. It's happening every day to millions of Americans who are not black, and they feel left out of the movement because the media and everybody just wants to focus on Black Lives Matter and black people's interaction with cops and black people getting brutalized by cops. And it's happening to millions of other Americans every day. Every day, this isn't a race issue. Here's one more clip, another C-SPAN call.
This is James out of Wendell, Idaho. Good morning.
I'm actually in Boise now, but the verdict is great. But you know, what's forgot about is that blacks are not the only people being killed. My friend was a young white Russian male who was here on a visa, and he was shot and killed by police. You know, and I almost was shot and killed myself by police when they went for their they said they were going for a taser, but they actually reached for their gun. And that's when I started screaming bloody murder for help. And that's when bystanders started noticing and the cops became, you know, startled. But my friend, he didn't deserve to die. And his mother probably cries herself to sleep every night. And he's not black. He's white. And, you know, and I feel like he was only targeted because he was an immigrant to this country.
See what I'm saying? See what I'm saying? And even he throws in that, you know, a little bit of tribalism there, that I feel like he was only targeted because he was an immigrant. No, it didn't have anything to do with him being an immigrant. This is happening to everyone in the police state that we live in. We live in a police state. We live in a police state. Edward Snowden tried to warn you that you live in a police state, an Orwellian police state, and you do. I mean, there's some good cops. There's a lot of good cops. Majority of the cops that I've had interaction with are good cops, but I've had interactions with bad cops, crooked cops. Everyone has. If that's the issue, let's focus on that issue. Why are we making it about race? And this is my best evidence that it's not about race. This is, again, the Attorney General from Minnesota, Keith Ellison, who prosecuted Derek Chauvin in the George Floyd case. And this is what he says in his own words. Take a listen.
Was this a hate crime? I wouldn't call it that. Because hate crimes are crimes where there's an explicit motive and of bias. We don't have any evidence that Derek Chauvin factored in George Floyd's race as he did what he did.
That's staggering right there, what he just says. We don't have any evidence that Derek Chauvin factored in George Floyd's race. We don't have any evidence of that.
You could have charged him with a hate crime under Minnesota law. Yeah. And you chose not to.
Could have, but we only charge those crimes that we had evidence that we could put in front of a jury to prove. If we'd have had a witness that told us that Derek Chauvin made a racial reference, we might have charged him with a hate crime. But I would have needed a witness to say that on the stand. We didn't have it, so we didn't do it.
The whole world sees this as a white officer killing a black man because he is black.
And you're telling me that there's no evidence to support that.
Absolutely astonishing. This is a 60 Minutes interview that he did last week, and it's absolutely astonishing. Why would the world see it through that racial lens? CBS. National Amusements, which owns CBS and a fifth of all the media in this country. Why would the world see it through that lens? Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, is getting rich at the same time everybody else is getting poor, and he's getting richer by billions, and he is in his Washington Post, which is one of the two papers of record, New York Times and Washington Post, is painting this through that lens and painting it in that narrative. Why would the world see it through that lens? Just blown away. He says it there on 60 Minutes that the whole world is viewing it through that lens, and there's no evidence that it has anything to do with race. And then Joe Biden's going to address a joint session of Congress, his first address of such, and he's going to talk about it through that lens. He's going to talk about systemic racism and all of it through a racial lens, because it's divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. And Jeff Bezos isn't the only one making money off of pushing this divide and conquer narrative. And the media is not the only one making lots of money pushing the divide and conquer narrative. The race pimps are getting paid pushing the divide and conquer narrative. Race pimps like I told you in my last podcast about the co-founder of BLM, Patrice Cullors, and how she's buying properties all over the United States, including in Beverly Hills, in predominantly white areas. It's the same thing Obama does. He's getting rich off his books and off pushing divide and conquer. He lives in Martha's Vineyard. It was real funny. Al Sharpton, on the morning of the trial, he posts a picture of him walking to his private G5 Gulfstream private airplane and saying, "I'm going to watch the verdict with the family," and he's walking to his G5. He's living high on the hog. He's living large. There's big money in being a race pimp. Take a listen to this new story about Patrice Cullors and this other organization that she founded to grift off of.
Patrice Cullors also founded a group called Reform LA Jails, which last year successfully led a ballot measure to reduce the jail populations in Los Angeles County. Turns out, in 2019, that jail reform group had quite the gathering at a Malibu beach resort called Calamigos Guest Ranch. The group spent more than $10,000 at the resort itself and $15,000+ on a conference center owned by the resort. We don't know why they gathered for this oceanfront meeting, because the Daily Caller News Foundation, which broke the story, can't find public records of the meeting. But critics say if everything is on the up and up, why did the jail reform group book the beach club through a consulting firm that just happens to be owned by Asha Bandel, the woman who co-authored Patrice Cullors' 2018 biography? Asha Bandel also raked in nearly $260,000 in consulting fees from, you guessed it, Reform LA Jail.
So this Reform LA Jails group hired their friend and paid her $200,000 in consulting fees. And then they're booking events in Malibu, beachfront, living it up. They're probably at the spa and everything. It's a grift. They're dividing you, and then they are living it up, getting paid. Getting paid. Listen to this race pimp who's everywhere butchering the English language, Benjamin Crump. Take a listen to this. This is, they were on The View, the George Floyd's brother there with Benjamin Crump. And they're asked directly about Joe Biden calling them. And listen to the things they say about Joe Biden, who wrote the crime bill, who voted for the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, who has supported this criminality, you know, for 45 years, even to this day, still supporting it. And take a listen to what these clowns say about Joe Biden. Don't forget the Floyd brothers, they got 27 million. Crump's got a little bit of that. He gets a little bit of everybody's. Crump's making that money. He knows how to make that money.
Terrence, President Biden called you right after the verdict came in. What did he say to you? And did he make you feel any sense of comfort?
Basically, you know, Biden, he's a great man.
He's a great man, Biden is.
He came to visit us numerous of times since the act of what happened to George. But he, you know, he was just telling us he know how it feels to lose someone, and he was praying for us.
Who doesn't know how it feels to lose someone? Who hasn't lost someone? Jesus. So, how many times is Biden going to play that? Oh, I lost my wife and my son. I suffered loss. Who hasn't suffered loss?
That's basically what everything was about, and he just made us feel a lot better because the president has so much to do, and he spent just that time with us.
He's real busy.
All feel good.
Can I say one thing? I think President Biden was a lot like your father, Megan, John McClane. He understood
John McClane. I swear, this guy butchers the English language. I mean, kids, if Benjamin Crump can make it through law school, you can make it through law school. Keep going.
Was a lot like your father, Megan, John McClane. He understood people. He understood how to empathize with people in their most darkest moments. And I thought that's what America needed. We needed people to see the humanity in George Floyd like we see.
Everybody saw the humanity in George Floyd. People on the right, on the left, everybody, I mean, it wasn't an issue about race when everybody saw the video of George Floyd. Pretty much everybody agreed when you saw that video for the first time. I mean, your heart sank. Everybody. No, it wasn't an issue of race until you guys used it. You used it to divide the nation. You used this guy, this poor guy, to get rich and to divide the nation. That's what you guys did. You did it. And you're doing it to this day. Now they're in North Carolina. And I'm not saying that, and this is what I need to make clear. I'm not saying that people shouldn't be demanding answers for what happened to Andrew Brown, and there shouldn't be protests. And I'm not saying there should be violence and all that, because I don't believe that that's the way that you get things done at all. I think that's how you get more boots on your neck and more restrictive policing, by acting in violence. That's just me. But I do agree with the fact that people should be demanding the video in North Carolina and demanding that we get answers to what happened to Andrew Brown. But why is it always Benjamin Crump and these other race hustlers who are there, you know, making money off of it, you know, stirring up the crowd, and they use the crowd. They use the crowd. The crowd is very significant in what they are doing. And like I said, I don't have a problem with that. That's part of your constitutional right to petition the government when you have grievances. It's part of the founding of this country. I don't have any problem with that. But as this escalates, as this turns into violence and more dividing and conquering, and it starts to spread out to other cities, and as we start getting into the summer, these guys, these race pimps that are making money off this, they need to speak out against the violence and say, that doesn't represent us. That's not what we're trying to do. This is Benjamin Crump in North Carolina just the other day. I want you to listen to him, and then we're going to listen to a little bit of Bakari Sellers, because Bakari Sellers is new on the scene, and he said, hell, if all these guys, all these race pimps are making all this money on this racket, I've been to law school, I should make some money too. So now Bakari Sellers is out there, and we're going to listen to Bakari Sellers change up his speaking, and he starts doing this this impression of Obama doing an impression of a black preacher. It's absolutely hilarious, but it's a hustle, people. It's a hustle. Listen to this.
Okay. I'm Attorney Ben Crump, and along with Attorney Harry Daniels and Attorney Bakari Sellers, we have the honor of representing the family of Andrew Brown. It's so important, y'all, that we not let them sweep this under the rug, because apparently before you all showed up, they just wanted to sweep it under the rug, as they have done other brothers and sisters who have been unjustifiably killed by the people who are supposed to protect and serve us. It's so very important that we have transparency, because if we don't have transparency, we can never get to accountability. And if we never get to accountability, we can never get to healing and trust. And so if we want to heal this community, if we want to heal this family, then Sheriff Wooten, then you need to be transparent. What is it on this video?
Yeah, we need to see the video, and I'm glad there's people there demanding. But why has it got to be Crump? Why has Crump got to have his hands in the pot at all times? Now let's listen to Bakari Sellers do his impersonation of Obama doing an impersonation of a black preacher. It's absolutely hilarious.
We'll be watching tomorrow is to say, Sheriff Wooten, you don't need to say no more. Come on. Just show the video.
Here comes Bakari.
Attorney Bakari Sellers.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Bakari. Hey, how you doing? Somebody in the crowd. Hey, Bakari. Hey, how you doing? Bakari about to make that money.
Attorney Bakari Sellers.
Hey, how you doing? I wish we were somewhere else. I wish Ben Crump wasn't so famous.
I agree. I just said that.
I wish we had a week where black folk weren't just dying.
Amen.
At the hands of law enforcement.
At the hands of law enforcement. What are you talking about? Where were you 2 weeks ago, Bakari? Where were you when 7-year-old... Jaslyn Adams was gunned down. Listen to this clip. She was gunned down in the drive-thru at McDonald's. Little girl trying to get a Happy Meal was gunned down in Chicago. And Benjamin Crump, Bakari Sellers, they were nowhere to be seen. And he says I'm tired of seeing, you know, black people dying at the hands of law enforcement and his, you know, black preacher cadence. We'll listen to more of it here in a moment. You know, but what about black people dying at the hands of other black people? What about little Jaslyn Adams, Bakari?
7-year-old girl shot and killed at a fast food drive-thru in the Holman Square neighborhood.
Brittany Garzillo is live for us outside Strozier Hospital. Brittany?
Well, Corey and Don, we've learned the name of that little girl, 7-year-old Jaslyn Adams. Her grandmother wants her to be remembered as a fun and lovable, free-spirited child. She says that Jaslyn...
It's a shame. It's sad. It's sad that this little girl was gunned down with gang violence. I guess her dad had went and peed on one of his rival gang members' graves, and then they retaliate on him, and you know, the poor little girl is caught in the crossfire and is dead. She's 7 years old. This happened in Chicago. No Ben Crump, no Bakari Sellers, nobody rioting, nobody looting for this little girl. There's no money in that. There's no money in going and talking about that for Bakari Sellers, for Benjamin Crump, and going and causing a crowd for this little girl and talking about the violence and gang violence in Chicago. There's no ends in that. It can make no ends. Here's more of Bakari.
You know, I say often that only in this country can you have the trial of Derek Chauvin be interrupted by the death of Dante Wright, be interrupted by the death of Adam Toledo, be interrupted by the death of Micaiah Bryant, and now we find ourselves here.
He just goes from Adam Toledo to Micaiah Bryant, which was everybody, you know, I mean, not everybody. There's still holdouts to say that was unjust, but you're crazy. Anyway, but he goes from Adam Toledo, who's not black at all. He's the little homie Hispanic guy in Chicago. He's from the same city where this Jaslyn Adams little girl was gunned down, in the same city in that same time period. He just brushes by her. He didn't even mention her here.
In Elizabeth City.
No money in that.
So I'm tired. But not very often in my legal career do I get the eyes of all of you all. And you know what else I'm tired of doing? I'm tired of grieving and crying. I'm tired of seeing the videos. Then we protest. Then we have a funeral. Then we have another shooting. We grieve. We cry. We protest. And
you got to see his hand, the way he's doing his hand motions and everything. I mean, it's going along with the cadence. He is literally trying to imitate Barack Obama.
What you all to do today is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Tell him,
because I want us to destroy the system.
Reach.
That keeps putting us in situations like this.
Right. Tell him, Bakari.
That means I want us to make sure that in the state of North Carolina, they can no longer hide videos from individuals who need to see it. That means I want each and every one of you all to take out your phones right now.
Listen to us raising his voice. This is hilarious. Bakari don't talk like that.
I want you to call.
That's the black preacher man hustle. And then Laura Ingraham called him out on it. It says he's talking in an accent that we've never heard Bakari talk in before. Yeah, we've heard that before. That's the black preacher man hustle. We heard it when Obama did it. We heard it when Al Sharpton does it all the time. Yes, and Bakari Sellers is new on the scene. He's trying to get paid. He's doing the black preacher man hustle cadence. Listen to him here. This is when he fires back at Laura Ingraham for calling him out on using this little hustle accent. Take a listen.
Attorney Sellers.
You know. You know,
some of the and this these are black people that are here. I guess they're in front of the courthouse or the sheriff's office there in North Carolina. And some of the black people start to heckle Bakari Sellers, and they're angry at him and Benjamin Crump. Black people are not stupid. They see these race vultures swooping in, picking up the money. And this one heckler starts to heckle Bakari as he starts speaking. And there is anger and chatter around the fact that some of the black people there in North Carolina don't feel that these lawyers, these race pimps are representing them. So that's what's going on in the beginning here.
One of the things that I wanted to mention today is that we have the privilege of, you know, my brothers, this is a message for everyone watching. Hey, you don't have to like us. That's fine, but please have respect for the family. So what we're trying to say is you don't have to care for Ben or Bakari.
I wish I could hear what that guy is screaming. I heard something about the cop, but they're heckling Bakari, and he's saying, you know, you don't have to like Benjamin Crump and you don't have to like me, because they're getting a lot of feedback. You know, the people recognize their hustle, and it's just hilarious.
Or Harry, you don't have to be Democrat or Republican. You don't have to be white.
They go and they get this guy, whoever this guy is that's heckling them. You can see them, you know, shuffle around, and I'm sure, you know, they got to him and told him that he's got to be quiet. You know, you're making us look bad.
Realize that what this family has not gotten is justice. We have an execution here in Elizabeth City. We have an execution here in Elizabeth City, and what I want people to understand while we have this execution is we demand justice from the sheriff's department. We demand justice from this district attorney. We demand justice not for anybody standing up here, but we demand justice for Andrew Brown and his family.
Amen.
Andrew Brown and his children. So you don't have to care or like Benjamin Crump. You don't have to like Bakari Sellers. You don't have to like Harry Daniels.
We don't like y'all.
Be a Democrat or a Republican to feel like injustice was done.
His voice getting louder doing that preacher man hustle.
You just have to have a beating heart or moral conscience to understand that injustice was done. So we will deal with people who may not like us. We will deal with people who may not vote like us. But at the end of the day, I do not care what you look like, who you pray to, where you walk, or how you vote. But what I do care about is the fact that an injustice was done. Now, y'all done got me carried away. I know that people said that, you know, I switched accents. But my daddy in Denmark, South Carolina, my daddy would always say, you never argue with a fool because you don't know who's watching. Amen. And they can't tell the difference.
All right. He's, you know, clapping back at Lori Ingram that said that he's using that Obama hustle man accent. Tell me he don't sound like Obama here.
And yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
I mean, that's not what Bakari's trying to go after here. Listen to this.
To be black, you don't have to be white. You just have to have a beating heart or moral conscience to understand that injustice was done. So we will deal with people who may not like us. We will deal with people who may not vote like us. But at the end of the day, I do not care what you look like, who you pray to, where you walk, or how you vote. But what I do care about is the fact that an injustice was done.
Yeah, Jaslyn Adams, to the little girl in Chicago, an injustice was done. Where were you then? Where were you? You know, why do you guys get to pick and choose which of these cases you're going to make high profile cases, and then you swoop in and pick up a bunch of cash? Why is that right? And you're 100% using that black preacher man hustle accent. You know it, Bakari. I have a prediction. I'm going to go out on a limb here. Bakari is going to be a very wealthy man here in the next few years. I'm just going to go out on a limb. I'm going to go out on a limb, say that Bakari Sellers is, and he probably he's a CNN commentator. He probably does very well for himself, but I think that he's going to be doing a lot better. Because when you're a race pimp, race is the business. And right now, people, business is good. All right, we'll be back with episode 89 soon. Please visit the website, share the podcast. Thank you guys for listening.